This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. In America's fast-paced, strive for success, go for the gold meritocracy, it's never too soon to start jockeying for advantage. That explains, in part, a booming industry that has many parents convinced that Mozart and interactive alphabet games are as vital to their infant's development as a mother's milk. Never mind that there's slim scientific evidence that Mozart or a host of so-called baby enrichment games actually makes children smarter, let alone improves their chances of Ivy League success. Some experts say the obsessive insistence that babies engage in productive play at all times deprives them of boredom, that precious chance to absorb and make sense of the world swirling around them. Up next on Point, extreme parenting, baby geniuses, and the baby enrichment industry. Joining me now from Southampton, New York, is Alyssa Quart. She's the author of the forthcoming book, Hot House Kids, The Dilemma of the Gifted Child. Her article, Extreme Parenting, appears in the July-August issue of the Atlantic Monthly. And Alyssa Quart, great to have you with us today.
Oh, great to be here.
And your piece in The Atlantic was fascinating, great reading, and obviously provides the germ for this show, so I'm really happy to have you here. In that piece, you write that the new child enrichment business has marched into babyhood, right through infancy and into the womb. You call this baby genius edutainment complex. What is that? What are you referring to?
Well, the baby genius edutainment complex, I saw it as a set of products and also a whole mentality about encouraging precocity and early intelligence in infants. Among the products are the DVDs and the videos that we associate with smart infants, baby Einstein, baby Van Gogh, this kind of thing, but yeah, also and smart baby formula.
Right. Sorry, Alyssa. Give us a sense of what these products actually are, because, of course, there are tons of parents out there listening who are going to know immediately, but there are a lot of people who might not.
Well, there'll be DVDs of children big and small holding violins, recorders, guitars, and cellos where there's a song in the background, do your best, never less. Mm-hmm. There'll be videos with young children on a putting green and a toddler wandering around a basketball court with puppets, the hopes of inspiring toddler athletes, the Vincent Van Gogh, baby Van Gogh series had a goat introducing infant to primary colors, and there's Van Gogh paintings of Starry Night and wheat fields with Reaper in the background, that kind of thing.
Right. Now, what's driving parents to buy into this? Why are they seem to be relatively easy prey in this day and age to this industry's marketing ideas?
Well, I think many parents just buy them in the way that they'd normally buy a toy or a video just to, take a shower while their baby's sort of sitting there in the chair and keeping them entertained. But I think there's also this sort of secret sense, even for parents who are just taking a shower, that, okay, maybe the kid's going to get a little smarter, going to get a little extra stimulation. This has been vetted by, educators or psychologists, these DVDs and toys. And so it's just a better product overall for their infant.
And it's going to give them certain advantages along the way that are all going to end up, of course, in having a brilliant kid who speaks two or three languages and will probably get into that Ivy League college. I mean, I know I'm exaggerating, but there is sort of that sense behind the marketing of this industry that you need to do this for your child if you're a serious parent, right?
I think so, especially the early language acquisition DVDs and so forth, or, Mandarin, Spanish, French, German, this kind of thing, which seems pretty clearly what you're talking about, creating bilingual children and, age 6 months or whatnot before speech.
But is there a concern? I mean, because running through your article in The Atlantic, there is this sort of sense that, people are being sold a bill of goods here. Are parents wrong to do this? I mean, isn't it understandable that as parents we want, as much as we can to benefit our children?
Yeah, I think what I got when I talked to parents, and also when I was watching these DVDs or looking at these products, is that, you know, there's great, all the best intentions behind them, but the problem is really the, you know, fascination with accumulating them and the sort of secret faith, as I said, that maybe they're making a difference as part of a larger complex. The Baby Genius Edutainment complex is the industry, but, you know, complex within parents as well and within families of that their kids have to be better earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the worrisome part of it, I think, on the parent side, although it's less worrisome than the products themselves, the way they're being marketed.
This idea that they have to be better earlier, sort of behind this issue, is that there's this very finite, brief window of opportunity to get to a kid and develop that little infant baby brain. And if you don't do it before the age of three or something like that, you've lost this this terrific opportunity to enrich him or her, correct? That's sort of behind some of the pressure here.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's one DVD that says the first 30 months of life is the period where a child's brain undergoes its most critical stages of evolution. So if you don't get them then, you know, it's all going to be a wash. You know, you better get in there then with your stimulating DVD.
And is that wrong? Do we have an idea that maybe that's incorrect?
Well, it's not it is incorrect. Brains are definitely, you know, incredibly plastic in that period. And there's a lot of immense amount of learning going on and development. But I guess my problem is there's development throughout life, and the sense that if you don't catch them, then, you know, you're going to lose all ability to learn is I guess I think it's sort of an ideology of as I said, earliness and precocity that does a discredits later learning that, mm-hmm. We know that people go on learning the rest of their lives. And, you know, why play that down?
And you write that the growth of this industry, the so-called baby genius edutainment complex, I love that term, owes this explosive growth to the sort of wake of the Mozart effect, this idea based on actual research at one point that a group of college students' ability to think actually improved after listening to Mozart. And this led to all kinds of reactions, including the then governor of Georgia, Zell Miller, sponsored an initiative to send classical CDs to every newborn in his state. But there's a problem with the Mozart effect, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, even the academics who named and discovered the Mozart effect question the application of it, because it was originally some college students. It was not infants at all. College students listened to 10 minutes of Mozart sonata, relaxation tape, and then silence. And then they took a sort of paper folding test. And those who had listened to the Mozart reportedly performed better than those who had not. It was hard to duplicate those effects overall. But at any rate, they were on college students. So it wasn't infants per se. And so even if it was true, it would be true for people who were 18 years old.
Hmm. It's interesting. I mean, as you mentioned, even one of the original researchers said there's no scientific evidence that playing classical music to babies makes them smarter.
Exactly.
That kind of that's pretty definitive debunking of the Mozart effect. How big is this industry in your reporting? I mean, did you get, you know, can you sort of put it in perspective? I mean, are we spending millions, billions, tens of millions? What are we spending as a nation on this industry?
Well, you know, it's hard to sort of sometimes separate out the kind of educational DVDs and videos from the DVDs and videos in general, but videos and DVDs for really young children, like preschool age and younger, earned $500 million in 2004, and the number's up.
$500 million, so half a billion dollars. That's
yeah.
some
mm-hmm.
serious change. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, this is an industry that didn't exist before 1997, so it's kind of interesting.
In your view, what does it do to the parents? I mean, does it, you know, in terms of the quality of parenting and their life? I mean, it seems to me that it's sort of adding a kind of level of stress that, oh my God, I got to make sure that this little precious baby of mine is getting absolutely the best I can, and maybe he's not learning Swahili in time or whatever it is, or being able to recite his alphabet or be able to sign. I mean, I noticed lately kids are learning to sign as they learn to talk, and they're not even part of the community that needs to sign.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't know. You know, it's a chicken or egg proposition. Like, is this creating the will to early achievement, or is the early achievement, fixation creating a market? Obviously, the people making the videos would say yes. It's the parents themselves that have created this urge, but it's hard to know, really. As one product that I thought was kind of amusing was this time tracker, which is a lighted test timer for children around 4 to get them to learn to ration out their time well for tests. So, is that product, tapping into a market, or is it making parents just freak out?
Jennifer is calling from Weymouth, Massachusetts. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. I'm a parent, and I have an MED in early childhood, and this is an issue that I'm extremely passionate about.
Well, and I'm glad you called. What's on your mind?
Well, what's on my mind is that we, as parents, we get inundated with all these child safety products, and parents are going nuts, covering shopping baskets with cloths so that their children don't get germs. But yet when it comes to television, I don't see parents out there following the American Academy of Pediatrics recommendation that children under the age of 2 should not be watching television. And I think that it is, in fact, harmful for the developing brain. So,
and you're raising this issue because a lot of these products, or a big proportion of these products, and Alyssa Quart, chime in here, are DVDs and with recommendations that very small kids under 2 years old, much younger than that, are going to benefit from watching videos. Is that right?
Yeah. There's been the recommendations that Jennifer just mentioned, that from the Academy of Pediatrics, that infants should not be watching television to the extent that they currently are, and young children shouldn't either. So in light of that, it sort of casts the DVDs in a darker, even darker light than the one that I did in my article. But I agree with her. I think that there is a sort of sliding scale for protection of children where, as she said, parents might be very afraid of contaminating their kids' mm-hmm. bodies, but not so much their minds.
Jennifer, let me ask you, I mean, how did you resist this? I mean, you said...
I have 2 children, and they're ages 2 and 3. I'm outside. They're playing right now because I believe children should be outside and experiencing real things. And I went 3 years with absolutely no television in the house because of what I read in Jane Healy's book, Endangered Minds, and from what I read when I was studying to get my master's, about how a child's brain is entirely different from an adult brain. So that when kids are repeating their ABCs when they're watching Sesame Street, what's more meaningful for young children is to learn how to communicate. You don't have to read at the age of 3, but the construct of language and how important language is, it's what separates us from beasts. And if you see over time, children's language has declined over time, and it's so important for future learning
okay.
that they need to play with the ball to understand what a ball is, not watch it on TV.
All right, Jennifer, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. I want to bring a Dr. Charles Nelson into this conversation. He's joining us from St. Paul, Minnesota. Dr. Nelson is professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. He's director of research, Developmental Medicine Center at the Laboratory of Cognitive Neuroscience at Children's Hospital in Boston. And Dr. Nelson, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, you've been listening to this conversation. Well, chime in any way you want. One of the things as the sort of scientist that I'd like to talk to you about is this idea of cognitive development. And, is there this finite window that we all need to jump on board with our babies and make sure that they get the exposure to all this stuff before the precious age of 2 or 3 or whatever it is?
No, not at all. I mean, this is based on the premise that the brain undergoes a very rapid development during the first few years, and we know that's true, but it's certainly not a critical period. In other words, it's not as though the door gets slammed shut at the age of two or three, and after that, any experiences aren't incorporated by the brain. It's just that the brain can make a lot of use of those experiences early on, but as Alyssa pointed out, it continues to make use of those experiences far beyond the infancy period. And I think what I've been hearing here is the assumption that if experience is important for the developing brain, which we know it is, then more experience or better experience, particularly in those early years, is therefore better for the baby. And there's no evidence that that's true, and there's probably good reason to think it's not true.
Is it harmful, though? I mean, is this obsession about these kinds of child development products, can they be potentially harmful?
That's a very good question. And there are a couple of ways that they do give me pause for concern. So I'll give you one example, actually, that your caller just mentioned. We're already concerned that our children are watching too much television. So here we are at a very early age, already, in a sense, in training children to watch television. Are we setting the stage for even more television viewing as these kids get to be preschoolers and elementary schoolers? Second of all, we know that learning takes best in a social works best, rather, in a social context. Mm-hmm. We know from the way kids learn language, we know from the way songbirds learn song, that these things happen in a social context, a parent talking to a child or playing with a child. We know that simply listening to language on an audio tape or watching a DVD is pale in comparison to the richness that kids experience in everyday life. So the second thing that could be harmful, I think, is that the environment in which these things are presented is impoverished. So contrary to the claims of the manufacturers that this is actually a form of enrichment, there are ways it's actually not enrichment, it's impoverishment.
Very interesting. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Anne, who's calling from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Hi, Anne.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Well, I'm very glad to be able to speak with you. I've been thinking about how important it is that children just grow up naturally. I mean, Einstein wasn't a super good student. He was famously not very good at it. Nobody was pushing him to be a genius or noticed that he was one. He was allowed to grow naturally into himself and to let things occur to him. And the best way to build better babies is by letting them breathe clean air and clean water and eat organic food, which you do yourself as much as possible, and to live in a peaceful way in the natural world with plants and animals and friendly people and beautiful music, whatever you love, and just to be a loving person in a loving family.
Well, I don't think anybody would disagree with that, Anne, and I thank you very much for that prescription. Alyssa Quart, does this stuff, you know, that we're talking about, this industry, does it somehow violate what Anne is talking about, a kind of natural way of bringing up kids?
I don't think so, but I think that it doesn't violate it, but it probably, as Charles Nelson just said, encourages children, parents to watch television with their infants or just have their infant watch television alone. So I don't know if it's a violation or it's just kind of learning how to live and how to be in a way that's completely mediated through a television set, which I guess is a violation. What am I saying? It's a violation. Okay.
Okay. Let me,
Anthony, I'm wondering if
yeah,
I could
sure, please, Dr. Nelson,
add a comment to this. I think what your caller just described, we might think of as the expected environment. So as we've evolved, our brains expect a certain type of environment, and television wasn't in that formula originally. And I think what we need to be mindful of is that these this new technology and the like, which can be tremendous in other contexts, early in development, it's not what the brain was expecting to be exposed to. So I think we need to step back and say, what is the brain really expecting? And my guess is that in most cases, it's expecting what we probably have in, well, hopefully have in most families, people who pay attention and talk to and love and interact with the child, who stimulate the child and the like. I think that we need to disentangle children who are growing up in typical environments versus those who grew up in deprived environments. These sorts of stimulation toys may, in fact, have some advantage for kids who live in profound deprivation. But the paradox is, what's the chance that they're going to have a $300 DVD player and television set to watch these DVDs if they live in profound deprivation? So in fact, the kids who least need these things are probably the majority of kids growing up in typical households.
Interesting. Let me bring in Dennis Fedoruk into this conversation. He's president of the Brainy Baby Company, which produces some of these products that we've been talking about. And Dennis Fedoruk, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Anthony.
And I hope you don't feel too unfairly assaulted by this, but there's a lot of sort of criticism, and it's only fair to bring you into this conversation and get you to respond to it. Let me ask you just about the Brainy Baby Company. You know, tell us about the products and what they can do for babies.
Well, Brainy Baby started way back in 1995 when there wasn't even a category called baby videos. So essentially, Brainy Baby invented the category, which is now, as Alyssa mentioned, over 500 million strong with all kinds of players in that market. However, it was started from our love of learning, teaching our children. My boys are now 11 and 13, and it was started out of a love of learning to teach them early learning concepts at home in a preschool level. That turned into a business. So we started off on a path of doing what is right and what is good for our kids that would, you know, give them a little head start in life. That turned into a business and a wide range of products that have grown now over the last 12 years. And the reason they've grown so successful is because Brainy Baby is a product that just simply works and has beneficial effect with tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of consumers in America alone.
And when you say beneficial effects, you're talking about beneficial effects for very small children, children between the ages of birth and age 3, for example, correct?
Well, we focus on the age of 1 to 5 primarily, and we have a very rigid, we have a very detailed parent guide that goes with all of our videos, and we're telling parents to use these responsibly as any other learning tool. Just as you'd use a book or a toy or interactive play or just going to ride your bike, this is yet one more tool in the arsenal of parental development.
I'm reading some of the literature from your own promotional material. Your child's education begins at birth, and we're proud to be involved. Brainy Baby products were created by a team of parents and educators to provide your child with the very best in early childhood education. It goes on to say that experts confirm that between birth and age 3, children absorb new sights, sounds, and information at almost 3 times the rate of adults. So you sort of promote this idea of this window of opportunity for your products.
Well, that's correct. There is a window of opportunity. Let's be honest. There is a window. What we make of that window is totally up to the parents. But we also, in that same parent guide that you're reading from, we go on to say that, you know, use the products responsibly, and we even say turn off the television and have your child go out and play. It's all a matter of balance. I mean, we do have cell phones, we do have microwaves, we do have, you know, we live, you know, it's 2006. So we have all these marvelous tools available to us, but any one of those tools needs to be used responsibly by the parent.
Dr. Nelson, what do you hear from the head of the president of Brainy Baby? I mean, does that sound reasonable? What he's saying?
Well, I appreciate the intent, but I have to sort of quibble with some of the science here. So an example is that embedded in this is the assumption that the baby's brain is a sponge and it just absorbs experiences. And we know that's not the case. Second, it completely disregards the role of genetics and the role of temperament, that there are huge individual differences among children. And any parent who's had more than one kid recognizes that. But this assumes that all brains are created equal and therefore will absorb this information at an equal pace or equally well, and that's not true. And I think the second thing, and I hate to sound like the scientific naysayer here, is that if I said to you right now, I have a magical potion that I could sell you that would make your hair grow or make you taller, I'm hoping you'd say, well, where's the scientific evidence for that? And I think I'm asking the same thing here. I'd like to see the data that showed that children who get these materials are smarter, have better outcomes later in life. Let me give you one example. There's a large literature on kids who are truly precocious. I mean, I'm talking about children who maybe when they're 6 are doing differential equations or speaking 12 languages or are, you know, reading Shakespeare fluently. If you look at their development, by the time they get to be adulthood, they're still very smart and successful, but they're not nearly as successful. And contributing to society as you would have expected when you saw them as children. And the point is that it's very difficult to make the assumption that what happens in those first few years is predictive of what happens later. Mm-hmm. And I would like to see the evidence that a child who sees these DVDs, for example, when they're one or two or three, if you look at that child 10 years later, if it really made any difference.
Well, let me put that to Dennis Fedoruk. Dennis, I mean, is there science behind this? Are there outcomes that you looked? Is there sort of empirical data that kind of tracks your products and can make a case for them?
Well, there is data that is emerging, and we are constantly asking organizations to see if they would do a study on this. And I agree with Dr. Nelson. There needs to be a thorough study on this, and we would like to be at the top of the list. We're confident that Brainy Baby would have a positive impact, and I can only tell you because of the thousands and thousands of testimonials from parents all over the world, really, and in your listening area, would call in and tell you that they have had a profound effect. Now, I know that's not scientific, and I know that we're, as a community, we're looking for something scientific, and that's why we're asking for those organizations to step forward and do this kind of study. There is a lot of research right now that is very interesting. There's a study called the Early Window Project back in 2001 that was funded by John Dee and Catherine MacArthur Foundation, and they conclusively came up with the findings that if programs are based on educational development and formative research, that children can actually learn educational content from viewing. And they went on to say that for very young children, viewing informative programming, that's the key word, informative programming, really helped children learn their letter word skills, number skills, and they became more school readiness, preschool readiness.
But isn't the part of the debate here about, it's not that viewing per se is necessarily a bad thing, it's when that viewing should take place. I mean, I note that the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends no screen time for babies under 2 years old, for example. You would disagree with them, probably.
I do, and the AAP does make that recommendation. However, if you look at the AAP's study, it's very clear their study did not take into account what type of television children were viewing. It's, you know, was it educational content or was it soap operas? That makes a big difference. And also, the study did not monitor the television habits in real time. They simply asked parents, how much TV has your child watched over the last 2 years? Now, that's not a conclusive study. And quite frankly, I think parents out there don't buy into this recommendation. And going back to what Alyssa said, that's why these products are still selling, because they see a positive effect in their own home, despite what the AAP says.
Peg is calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Peg.
Hi there. This is a very interesting conversation, and I have two points to make. One is that I was born in 1963, and so I came of age with Sesame Street, and Gifted and Talented Children and Precocious Children, and I was one of them, actually. They weren't really especially nurtured. It wasn't really this ubiquitous phenomenon that it's become. And I was very thankful that I had a handful of teachers who actually sort of reached out and tried to help me nurture certain things. But I also had the wonderful kind of upbringing that your caller Ann talked about, with lots of animals and plants in the outdoor world, and, you know, so very healthy like that. But I have to say, I wonder if this phenomenon isn't a result of a certain generation of parents sort of feeling resentful and left out of that gifted, talented nurturing, and so they're sort of forging it on their children in this way that parents have of living, you know, sort of vicariously through their kids these days. And I teach college students now, and to sort of go to your point of this, how does this let kids become healthy adults? I don't know that it does, because a lot of my students have this extreme sense of entitlement. They expect an A for showing up and doing the bare minimum. They're reading and writing skills are heartbreakingly bad, you know, and I just kind of wonder, this culture in which all kids are winners, all kids are special, all kids are brilliant, doesn't really allow kids to sort of make the mistakes and endure the growing pains they really need to become, you know, adults that actually kind of strive to challenge themselves.
Interesting, Peg. It's a great and provocative point that I'd love to put to my guests. Alyssa Court, let me start with you. You know, what do you make of that, this idea that parents are resentful or somehow overcompensating from the kind of privileges and special treatment and coddling that they didn't get?
I think perhaps that's true. But I also think that what seemed most salient to me was what Peg just said was parents who are raising kids who are not able to make the mistakes that children and infants should be able to make or feel like they're not able to because they're they're being told they're gifted. And there have been studies done that children who are told that they're gifted rather than just simply doing a good job actually perform worse. So I think there's a problem with trying to promote brightness and giftedness as a category rather than just encouraging good work and you know, a happy childhood.
Hmm. Dennis Fedoric, president of the Brainy Baby Company, I'd love to get you to respond to Peg. I mean, she sort of draws a line from some of these products that your company puts out. I mean, she didn't mention Brainy Baby by name, but this idea that it's sort of showing up years later as sort of overindulged kids in college and so forth. I mean, I my guess is you have a different point of view.
Well, I don't entirely agree with Peg, not as it relates to the products that are being out there on the marketplace. I do agree with Peg that some of the entitlement issues that are out there are very real, but I don't think making the connection to a children's DVD is the beginning of that process. I'm hearing a lot of comments about the pressure to get parents to, you know, they're overperforming and getting their kids to perform and all this. You know, I really think we need to back up and take a look at this. Parents are not freaking out and rushing to buy these products to create the next Harvard grad. That just isn't the real environment.
But you don't think that's a part of it? I mean, I can talk to you about this as a parent. I mean, I'm not saying I'm freaking out and running out, but when you bring a baby into the world, you are very susceptible to, you know, a lot of ideas about what can I do to give my child the best chance and so on and so forth. I mean, my child was born in 1997, right when I guess the baby Einstein phenomenon sort of took root. So we didn't go through this. But I think I would have been susceptible to that, too. And it's not that we were freaking out. It's just there is this natural sort of, oh, my God, I've got to do that, too. I've got to keep him safe. I've got to get a helmet for the bicycle. I've got to get the right car seat. I've got to get the right seat belt. You know what I'm talking about.
I do. And look, my wife and I do the same thing with our children. But, you know, you get to the point where you sort of just mellow out in that and you become a parent. You become relaxed in becoming that parent. You know, and I think what you're talking about, Anthony, is, you know, if you're a parent, don't you simply want the very best for your child? And if there's a tool available out there, like a Brainy Baby video or whatever tool that's available that can give your child a little advantage, you know, and it has a positive effect, and you see that positive effect with the product, what's wrong with that?
Mm. Dr. Charles Nelson, anything wrong with that argument?
Well, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. Let me put a slightly different spin on this.
Sure.
Maybe a little bit more generous towards parents. I think, and Dennis raised this point, I think parents inherently want to do what's best for their kids. I think it's a very strong drive, and it doesn't end when kids get to be 4 or 5. As a proud owner of a 20-year-old, I can tell you that it continues right through adolescence. Mm. I think parents are also, though, inherently self-conscious about not always knowing what's the right thing to do. I don't know a single parent who hasn't kicked him or herself and thought, God, what did I do that for? So I think we depend on experts a lot. And since I'm on now both sides of the fence, the problem is that we often can't really judge who the right expert is. So marketing is a very effective way of saying, we have expertise, we're making these claims. And in some ways, there's nothing wrong with that. But I think what parents are striving for is their uncertainty about what is best for their kids. And they'll go to any source that will help them. It can go be to the web. It can be commercials, their pediatrician, their neighbors. And I think some of that is what's driving this, coupled with, I think, a very competitive society. A lot of what we're describing is very unique to Americans. Mm. I spent a lot of time in Europe and Eastern Europe, and this is not something you see there very much at all.
Alyssa, let me ask you about that. The growth of this industry, the willingness of so many of us to go along with it and buy into it. Dr. Nelson talks about, you know, what it says about our society as a whole. What do you think it says?
Well, I definitely think it's a kind of American impulse. I saw it as a desire to control kind of natural processes and to harness nature, to use time shrewdly. I mean, this goes back to Benjamin Franklin. There's been a you know, use time shrewdly is a maxim that Americans like to follow. And what's a better example of that than trying to use those first 3 years of an infant's life to its maximum, you know, result?
Alice is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Alice.
Hi. This to me is almost part of our evolutionary process, both in childhood education and the growth of mankind. I know from experience that parents, no matter what, need all the help they can get. But I think the best thing for babies is to be wanted and then just be yourself.
Well, I don't think anyone would disagree with that. What's your take, though, on this sort of booming industry of products to help parents take care of their babies and give them all?
Well, I think of several phases we've gone through. I think this is a high-tech age, and there's so much more thrown at parents these days, and so much more. Well, it's a reflection of the status of our society as a whole, and that I think we've kind of opened a Pandora's box with some of this progress in the information age.
Well, I think plenty of people would agree with you there. Alice, thanks so much for the call. Let's go.
Anthony, may I respond to Dr. Nelson?
Sure, you can, Dennis. Go ahead, Dennis Fedoric, president of Brainy Baby.
Thank you. I was just responding back to Dr. Nelson's comment. And Dr. Nelson, I agree with what he's saying, that perhaps there are, you know, when you get into the mega corporations that are out there, that, you know, I think, you know, marketing and some of the advertising that goes on can be overwhelming to parents, and maybe that is influencing their thinking, especially the young new parent. You know, however, you know, there comes a point where you have to make a decision, and I think parents, we need to give parents the choice. We need to give parents enough credit for making a wise decision. When we market the Brainy Baby products, our products are purely marketed by word of mouth. We don't even have a marketing department. We don't have an advertising budget. So we simply rely on, if we've developed a good product that works, then we want that mother to tell another mother or tell a father, and hopefully the word spreads that way. So that's why we may not have that evidence that's scientific, but we do have the parental evidence that suggests we are having a positive impact.
But isn't this so much to do? I mean, I think the last caller, Alice, sort of put her finger on it. I mean, parents are overwhelmed, and maybe this is a question to both you, Dennis, and Charles, and that is, you know, you can disagree about whether these products are really good for kids, but parents are overwhelmed. They need resources to help them care for their kids. Better a Brainy Baby video than something that came before it, perhaps.
Well, I would say that, you know, if the parents are purchasing a product, and mind you, they're not spending, you know, hundreds and hundreds of dollars on a product. They're buying a $15 video here. If they're buying a product and has a beneficial effect, then why not roll with that? We don't have any evidence whatsoever that videos or DVDs are conclusively harmful to children in any way.
Well, we have evidence, don't we? We don't have any conclusive evidence. I mean, doesn't the recommendation from the American Academy of Pediatrics is based on evidence?
We have more research in this country and universities across this country that suggests that television viewing for young children is more beneficial than any of the research that the AAP is quoting.
Dr. Charles Nelson, do you want to chime in on this point?
Yeah, I think I need to qualify Dennis's last point. If it's educational television, Sesame Street might be an example. Yes, there are some benefits to that. But if a three-year-old is watching Terminator 2, I would be hard-pressed to say that that's good for them. Mm-hmm. I think that, again, going back to the point that parents need some help and they're feeling overwhelmed, on the one hand, it's virtuous to think that they'll go to any extreme to do what they think is best for their kid. What I worry about, though, and this might only apply to a small minority of parents, is they think that plopping their kid down in front of the television watching one of these videos is a substitute for the kinds of one-on-one interaction that they should be having with their child. I think if it's titrated so that they're getting both, it's probably not having any negative
effects
at all.
What does that mean? What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is, as long as the child is getting both the one-on-one contact with the caregiver and watching some of the videos, I think what I worry is a parent misinterpreting this and thinking this is a substitute for what I have to do as a parent and therefore give up that responsibility and give it over to the television. That's a concern. Whether there are parents who do that, I don't know, but I've never ceased to be amazed at the things parents do.
Anthony, I would have to agree with Dr. Nelson 100%. We certainly don't, and we would not recommend a parent using videos as an electronic babysitter. That's not the point. The point is to use any of these tools, including Brainy Baby, as another tool that's supplemental in addition to whatever the parents are teaching them on a one-on-one basis. Mm.
Let's try to get a couple more of our listeners into this conversation. Diana is calling from Boston. Hi, Diana.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I have a lot on my mind. I'm the mother of a one-year-old and a three-year-old, and it wasn't until just recently that the three-year-old began to watch videos a couple of times a week, like Bob the Builder or whatever.
Mm. And what have you seen? What have you observed? Has this helped your three-year-old?
No, the kids don't need this. And all the slick talk in Madison Avenue marketing that you want to put around it, is not going to, you know, refute the fact that they don't need it, it's not good for them. But why parents use it is because parenting is exhausting work, and it takes a lot of energy to interact with your kid and to read and to sing. And that's what they're doing. They're trying to cope. They're not trying to get their six-month-old into Harvard. They're trying to get time to take a shower or to make a phone call. And that's the reality. Like a stay-at-home parent or even a working parent who comes home and needs time to make dinner, you just stick the kid there. It is an electronic babysitter.
Well, there's the voice of experience. Let me just come back to you, Diana, because I'm curious, you know, have you changed the way you use these products with your one-year-old after having the experience with a three-year-old? Or you're just saying no? Right.
The experience is the same. Our role as parents, we feel, is to protect them as much as possible from this media.
Sure. Okay. Dennis, do you want to respond to Diana's point? I mean, it seems we keep coming back to this idea. Parenting can be very demanding, especially with two jobs in a household, and these products can help ease the stress.
Diana is giving us a taste of the real world, and we all know as parents that parenting can be very stressful at times. You know, I agree with what she's saying, that it is very stressful. But if you're going to, you know, use videos at all, then why not have something that's educational? I mean, if you're turning on the television and they're watching broadcast television, that, you know, like Terminator, as Dr. Nelson said, that's totally inappropriate and not responsible parenting.
Let's take one more call. Tony is calling from Troutman, North Carolina. Hi, Tony.
Hey.
What's on your mind? Thanks for the call.
No problem. I have nothing against your guests and, you know, the DVDs and the TV, the educational programs and stuff like that, but what I've read, I've read that TV, like, shuts off logical processing, the more flashier the program, but, like, you know, just basically, pretty much is it puts your brain, like, I don't remember, it's like, I don't remember if it's the right brain or the left brain, but, you know, they have pretty much separate things, but...
So you're saying that TV viewing could actually affect the way the brain works in a bad way?
Definitely, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And, well, let me put that to Dr. Charles Nelson. We don't have a whole lot of time left, and I'm sure Dennis Fedoric wants to chime in on this. But Dr. Nelson, is there concern that Tony is referring to? Is that valid?
No. I mean, fortunately, there's no concern in the sense that there are no studies that have ever addressed this. And actually, if I just think it through myself, I wouldn't worry about that. Now, again, if a child is watching 5 hours a day of Terminator 2 from the time they're 2 until they're 20, then I think we have a bigger problem on our hands. And it may not be the effects of television as much as why is that child sitting in front of the television so much?
Sure.
So it's more a matter of what they're not doing when they're watching television. Television shouldn't be just the bad boy here, I don't think.
Right. But what's behind the American Academy of Pediatrics sort of saying there shouldn't be any screen viewing before 2 years old? I mean, that's not based on some physical thing that's going on in the head?
Again, well, it isn't based on anything going on in the head. That is, there are no data to this. This is what I do for a living, and I would know if someone had done a study looking at the effects of television on the two-year-old brain. Rather, what they're saying, which is very reasonable, is during those years, what's most important is for babies to have contact with people, with other people. And the more time spent in front of a TV, the less time spent interacting with another human being. I think that's what they're arguing. And there is a lot of evidence to suggest that those first 2 or 3 years really does need to be spent in context with a social relationship.
Okay.
And a TV you don't have a relationship with.
Dennis Fedoric, we literally have 10 seconds left, but I want to give you a chance to have the last word here.
I would tell you that content matters. TV's not the big bad monster. It's the content that matters. And videos like Brainy Baby, if they have good educational content, can make a positive difference.
Thank you all for joining us. Alyssa Quart, thanks for your work in the Atlantic Monthly, and thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
That's Alyssa Quart. Her article, Extreme Parenting, appears in the July issue of the Atlantic Monthly. Dr. Charles Nelson joined us from St. Paul, Minnesota. Thank you, Dr. Nelson.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me
on. And Dennis Fedoric, president of the Brainy Baby Company, thank you.
Thank you very much.
You can continue the conversation, download the On Point podcast at onpointradio.org. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.